that Dr. Luke would write to his mate, and we get to read it. And that's where we're sort of working our way through. And we're up to chapter 7, Luke chapter 7. But I want to tell you about a time where there was an Englishman, a Scotsman, and an Irishman. Now, hopefully I don't offend too many people. I thought I could have gone, there was a Tasmanian, a Victorian, a South Australian, but I'd probably offend more people if I do that. So I went with an Englishman, Scotsman, and Irishman. They're in a bakery. And while the baker's back is turned, the Englishman nicks three biscuits, puts them in his pocket, quick as a flash. Englishman turns to the Scotsman and said, "See how quicker we are than the Scotsman? You couldn't do that." Scotsman stands there and thinks for a while. He says, "Watch this. Scottish people are always cleverer than the English." And so he says to the baker, "Can you give me one of your biscuits? I'll show you a trick." So the baker reluctantly hands the Scotsman a biscuit and he woofs it down. It's gone. Nothing happens. And then the Scotsman turns to the baker, who the baker is the Irishman, by the way, and says, "Can you give me another biscuit?" And somewhat reluctantly, the baker gives the Scotsman the biscuit and he woofs it down. And then the baker's getting suspicious when, for the third time, the Scotsman says, "Give me another biscuit for my magic trick." So somewhat suspicious and getting increasingly angry, the baker gives him a third biscuit and he woofs it down. And then he says, "So where's your magic trick?" says the baker. He says, "Look in the pocket of the Englishman." Thanks, Zach got it. Good. Well, Joel, sorry. Well, the mask, you know. In this story today, there's three, if you like, actors on this scene. And for predominantly most of it, there's nothing frivolous about it. In fact, it's really heart-rending because we have in this scene a centurion, a widow with a dead son, so she's doubly grieving, and we've got a sinful woman. That's the description that we have. And Jesus in Luke 7, we get to see how he shows compassion on a centurion, a man of war, who had more faith than anyone in Israel, says Jesus. We also have this widow who is doubly bereaved and a sinful woman. And the dominant theme is faith. Faith that has no racial or gender gaps. In fact, one of the themes that runs through Luke's letter is the idea of gender and the value of women, which was counter to the culture that he was writing in. The witnesses to these stories, and we will be witnesses to them today, they respond in one of two ways. The crowds would acknowledge the events as evidence of a divine visitation. God in some way is with them. In verse 16 it says, "Great fear swept the crowd, and they praised God, saying, 'A mighty prophet has risen among us, and God has visited his people today.'" The second mob, regarded simply as the Pharisees, looked with suspicion by a man by the name of Simon. And in Luke chapter 7, verse 39, he said, "When the Pharisee who had invited him," that's Jesus, "saw this, he said to himself, If this man were a prophet, he would know what kind of a woman is touching him. She's a sinner. He said it with absolute contempt, not just towards the woman, but towards Jesus. He was a skeptic. He had figured that if Jesus was truly a prophet, he would have known, and here's the judgment, who this woman really is that's touching him. So Luke is calling for faith response to this Jesus. So I wonder how you'll respond today. Whether you're a follower of Jesus or still on that journey to find him, today there is a call for a faith response. Firstly, we see the Gentile centurion. He's more than likely a mercenary. The Romans weren't engaged in this part of the Middle East until about AD 44 as centurions themselves. He's a Gentile, which is someone who is not a Jew. And in Luke chapter 7, verse 1 through 10, it says, "When Jesus had finished saying all this to the people, he returned to Capernaum. And at that time, the highly valued slave of a Roman officer was sick and near death. And when the officer heard about Jesus, he sent some respected Jewish elders to ask him to come and heal his slave. So they earnestly begged Jesus to help the man. 'If anyone deserves your help, he does, for he loves the Jewish people and even built a synagogue for us.' So Jesus went with them, but just before they arrived at the house, the officer sent some friends to say, 'Lord, don't trouble yourself by coming to my home, for I'm not worthy of such an honor. I'm not even worthy to come and meet you. Just say the word from where you are and my servant will be healed. I know this because I am under the authority of my superior officers and have authority over my soldiers. I only need to say, go and they go, or come and they come. And if I say to my slaves, do this, they do it.' And when Jesus heard this, he was amazed." He was gobsmacked. He was staggered. He'd never seen anything like this before. He said simply, "I tell you, I haven't seen faith like this in all Israel." And when the officer's friends returned to his house, they found the slave completely healed. This is also a story of ethnic cooperation that was unheard of. You have a Gentile who is a centurion, who's mates with the Jews. He gets the Jewish elders, who, by the way, he built a synagogue for, to go and see Jesus and say to him, "Can you come and help me?" Plus, he's wanting to help someone who is not a soldier, but somebody who is a slave of a soldier. So it crosses, goes across all sorts of different levels. We see an image of the synagogue that's still there in Capernaum, whether this is the original one or another since. You can visit there today. Most of us, by the way, don't live with very clear authority structures. Some of you do. You've come from a military background. There were clear authority structures that this centurion understood and recognized. And as a leader of 100 men, he understood the authority that Jesus had. Again, authority is an interesting word in Australia these days. We don't always like it. I remember a time where I was with TASPOL many years ago, and my senior sergeant asked me to shift my car because it was parked in a limited time zone. And he said to me, "It's not a good look if we officers, coppers, are parking our cars there and the general public get booked if they do it." So I sort of acknowledged that he told me that and went away and got busy doing other things and clean forgot, filed it away. Anyhow, I get called on the mat. You see, in that work setting, authority was not only understood, it was reinforced. And so that my senior sergeant reminded me, "Didn't I ask you to do this?" I said, "Yeah, you did, boss." "You didn't do it." I said, "No. I apologize." You see, lines of authority were really clear. You and I live in a world where lines of authority aren't always really clear. And sometimes we look at God or Jesus as not really one who has authority over our lives. It's sort of like an optional extra, that because he's not there right in front of us like a policeman with his hand up doing this. And so we sort of just don't acknowledge God for who he is. This Roman centurion understood authority and understood that his life rested under the authority of God. Interesting. He acknowledged this authority of Jesus. One writer says, God's sovereignty in Jesus Christ is exercised with love and compassion. But if we think it is as any less absolute than that of a military officer, we are, according to the passage, not only misguided, but also lacking in faith itself. Remember, the one who gets the highest commendation in the New Testament for faith is not even someone who is of Israel. It's a centurion. His story is one where, though feeling unworthy to approach Jesus, he says in the text, Lord, don't trouble yourself coming to my home, for I'm not worthy of such honor. I'm not even worthy to come and meet you. Jesus welcomes his faith as nothing he'd seen before in Israel. Here's a middle-ranking military officer used to giving orders, a sympathizer of the Jews with a heart of compassion for the slave of one of his officers, who acknowledged the authority of Jesus to heal in the name of God and felt unworthy for himself to even trouble this Jesus. Sounds like a mate of mine that I haven't seen for over 20 years. I mentioned here before, we used to do martial arts together. He used to beat me up. And he went a different direction, and his life was interesting and colorful. And he got back in touch with me, and he shared how he had had a, I'll use the word religious experience, a spiritual experience. I said his life was colorful, it was. And yet at one point God broke through to his life, and he felt like this centurion, totally unworthy to even bother Jesus. And for something over a week or 2 weeks, he would weep at his sin. He knew what his life looked like, what he had done, the people he had offended and hurt. And God brought him to his knees in a most wonderful and heartwarming way. What did he feel? The judgment of God? He felt the love and compassion and forgiveness. I wonder if you feel worthy to approach God today. Or maybe what keeps you away is the idea of the institution of the church, what you think church looks like or feels like, or what you read in the media. Don't let that keep you from finding God. My friend is now working through resolving so many of that brokenness of his life. I think probably like the centurion who's received the hand of Jesus in his healing of his friend. In verse 9 says, when Jesus heard this, he was amazed. Turning to the crowd, I tell you, I haven't seen faith like this in all of Israel. Tell me, what if Jesus would have said, I haven't seen faith like this in all of the church? What is it when somebody outside of the church has faith that God is amazed? What does our faith look like today? We move on. For all his lack of appropriate religious background, he had understood that this one true God was personally present and active in this Jesus of Nazareth. Secondly, we come to the widow's son, now doubly bereaved. In Luke 7, verse 11 through 15, soon afterward, Jesus went with his disciples to the village of Nain, and a large crowd followed him. Nain's a little village about 10 km southeast of Nazareth. And a funeral procession was coming out as he approached the village gate, which was what would happen. They wouldn't have someone lie in state for a long time. There were no fridges. Someone would die. They would somehow make sure that that person was actually deceased. Sometimes they would wrap them in funeral clothes. Certainly they would use ointments and salves that would create a reasonable smell. It was very earthy. What they'll do is not necessarily like a coffin like we would imagine. It may be on boards. And this person would be carried out of their home and would be carried through the village. Sometimes they would have professional mourners who would make loud noise. If Middle East funerals are quite dramatic, loud, wailing. And Jesus is coming into Nain, and he comes across this funeral scene, which is quite traumatic, as they carry this boy through the village, and people are weeping and there's tears. Doubly so, she is a widow, so this is her only son. This is a son who would look after this lady. See how Luke interweaves, particularly his ministry, the ministry of Jesus with women, and the heart that he has, the compassion that comes. And he comes across this funeral scene, and Jesus intersects with our humanity in a really graphic way. It says here, the young man who had died was a widow's only son. A large crowd from the village was with her, and when the Lord saw her, his heart overflowed with compassion. He says, don't cry. Then he walked over to the coffin and touched it, and the bearer stopped. Young man, I tell you, get up. Then the dead boy sat up and began to talk, and Jesus gave him back to his mother. Now, just in case you're wondering, Luke isn't the only writer in the New Testament that tells the story. It's sort of verified through various witnesses. This is outside of our human understanding. Dead people don't normally get up, but this isn't a normal person you're talking about. This is a visitation from God that Israel had been waiting for some 400 years. Two parts to this story. Jesus raises the dead son of a widow, displaying the kind of powers similar. I want you to put your Jewish hat on. Who would it remind you of? If you're a Jew there, seeing this take place, what happened in the Old Testament? Elijah and Elisha. And the language that's used here is Old Testament language. You read about those two men in 1 Kings and 2 Kings. This led the people to understand that this Jesus was a prophet through, and that through him God was, and here's the phrase, visiting his people. It's not like what might happen at your place, say midweek, you get someone knock on your door and they drop in and for a bit of a yarn, sit down and say hello. The idea of this phrase, visiting his people, it's very Old Testament. It's the idea of God has come near to save us and rescue us. Think of the Exodus. When God's people have been crying out to God to deliver them, the phrase there is around this idea of God has come near and God would rescue his people. That's what they'd been waiting for. It says in verse 14, then he walked over to the coffin and touched it. And by the way, this is ceremonial anathema. You just do not do that. You would be unclean to touch this coffin, this burial procession. Not only that, the one with no capacity to hear because he was dead, heard. Young man, Jesus said, I tell you, get up. And the one who was lifeless talked and got out of the coffin, and the dead man lived. You know, if there was no authority in the words of Jesus, his words would be just simply blackly humorous or tragically misguided. Did you notice, though, where faith was in this passage? Remember with the centurion, Jesus said, I've never seen faith like this before in all of Israel. Where was the faith in this passage? We don't read it from the widow. The guy who is dead is dead. Where's the faith? It's in Jesus. Jesus. Enter into this story afresh. Be swept away by what is taking place here. Stand in the crowd of mourners on a hot Galilean day with tears mingled with sweat. Be overcome with the sound of wailing and the crying of grief. You may or may not feel comfortable, but close your eyes. Don't snooze off just yet. Take what you've seen here and think of what you're entering into this week. For some, there will be a funeral procession this week for a young lady who's died tragically at the age of 18 years. That sobers us up somehow and reminds us that our lives hang on a very thin wire. What do you face this week? Or something that sits unresolved in your life? Or your fears, your anxieties, your stresses? Allow Jesus, just as he does in this funeral procession, to come alongside, hearing your cry of anguish or grief or pain or confusion. Hear the compassion in his voice. Feel his touch. Know his presence. Sense his heart today. It's his presence with you in the coming week or in the coming months that will be all that you need, whatever the outcome. You can open your eyes or sit in that space for a time. I don't mind. There's a book that came out last month. It's called How God Works, The Science Behind the Benefits of Religion. It's a good read. Well, it might be. The Science Behind the Benefits of Religion by David D'Esteno. Came out in September. And he writes this because the title piqued my interest. For most of my adult life, I didn't pay religion much heed. Like many scientists, I assumed it was built on opinion, conjecture, or even hope, and therefore irrelevant to my work. He's not writing from a Christian framework, by the way. That working is running a psychology lab focused on finding ways to improve the human condition, using tools of science to develop techniques that can help people meet the challenges life throws at them. But in the 20 years since I began this work, I realized that much of what psychologists and neuroscientists are finding about how to change people's beliefs, feelings, and behaviors, and how to support them when they grieve, and how to help them to be more ethical, and how to let them find connection and happiness, echoes ideas and techniques that religions have been using for thousands of years. The title of the book is How God Works. I wanted to, I may, email him. It's not about ideas and techniques that religion uses. It's about a person, Jesus Christ. And as we come to know who this Jesus is and experience his love and his forgiveness for some, his healing and restoration that takes our brokenness and pieces our life back together, we will become more meditative. We will read scripture. We will pray. We will seek the divine outside of ourselves. Jesus' ministry here is about compassion. It is able to overcome the fear and pain of death. He brings hope to the grieving and lost. And now we see in this final picture how he brings forgiveness in all of its fullness. And the next person that we look at, the scriptures simply describe as a sinful woman. Don't get hung up on the phrase. We don't even know what her name is. It's one of the most beautiful pictures you'll find in the New Testament. Read with me, Luke 7:36 through 39. One of the Pharisees asked Jesus to have dinner with him. That in itself was unusual. Pharisees tend to be ultra-right. So Jesus went to his home and sat down to eat. And when a certain immoral woman from that city heard he was eating there, she brought a beautiful alabaster jar filled with expensive perfume. Some writers describe this perfume as being something worth like a year's wages. That adds weight to what we're about to see. Then she knelt behind him at his feet, the feet of Jesus, weeping. Her tears fell on his feet and she wiped them off with her hair. Then she kept kissing his feet and putting perfume on them. When the Pharisees who had invited him saw this, he said to himself, "If this man were a prophet, he would have known what kind of woman is touching him. She is a sinner." See how he missed it? He totally missed it. And Jesus goes on and says, Simon, I need to tell you a story. Is that okay? And he says, sure, tell me a story. And he tells a parable. We might get there before we finish. If you've ever visited the Louvre in Paris, there's a picture there of probably one of the most famous, the Mona Lisa, and we dropped in there. It's funny, it's only a little thing. Probably one of the most famous portraits in there. A writer by the name of Bock says, in the Bible, there is no more beautiful portrait of humble, loving faith than this woman's silent but vibrant statement. The story of Jesus at the house of Simon the Pharisee is as full of meaning, of gospel, good news, as any story in the New Testament. We have Simon, an unnamed woman. With the behavior of Simon and the woman both equally outrageous. One rudely disrespectful and the other full of devotion. Simon, who tended to be the right, in fact probably more ultra-right, very unusual for him to go want to have a meal with this person that he suspected to be a prophet, particularly seeing this prophet was continually accused by this religious right of hanging out with sinners and tax collectors. But anyhow, we find Simon at this inviting Jesus as a guest in his place. The woman, she has a reputation. The image that we have, we bring that up. This is by Rubens. I don't know, maybe those faces of the men in the background are the ones who are a part of her illicit reputation, as is true in that era and in somewhat in today. It's the woman who is known for her story or her reputation, and yet at the risk of ridicule and public humiliation, she comes in to anoint Jesus, but is so overcome with emotion that she wets his feet with her flowing tears. Look at that image. Have you ever been so overcome in love with Jesus that you have wept at his feet? And then she does something even more horrendous in the culture of the day. She looses her hair, lets it run down. A woman of a repute would never have her hair down. If you've got your hair down today, it's okay. We're in a different culture, but in that culture, unheard of. And what does she do with her hair? As her tears run down her face onto the feet of Jesus, she wipes his feet with her hair. See the intimacy of this? There's nothing weird. It is just bold, raw, broken emotion. All that she had known at the hands of men was abuse and being used. And she'd heard about this prophet called Jesus. And she comes to him to anoint his feet with this incredibly expensive perfume. She doesn't even get that far. She breaks down in tears because she's overcome with love for Jesus and then wipes his feet with her tears. One of the most intimate passages. And here that Luke paints for us this picture of what happens when God's love with the gospel collides with fallen human frailty. Yours and mine. Our human frailty. She's the recipient of love and forgiveness seen through God's eyes as opposed to the eyes of those around her who would condemn. Have you had those eyes upon you? God sees beyond our human frailty and chooses to love us with an eternal love. That's why his son would die on a cruel cross, not because his mission went wrong, but because he loves you. He sees beyond your brokenness and your human sin and says, I want to be in relationship with you. And this woman in some way understood that and felt not his condemnation, but his forgiveness and his welcome. And wherever you have come from today, that same God offers you that same gift of welcome, of forgiveness. If Jesus' receiving of the sinner is a challenge, his declaration of forgiveness of sins is a massive problem, particularly for Simon. But for Luke, true faith is what happens when someone looks at Jesus and discovers God's forgiveness. Then they respond in love to his love. So, remember as we started? Two responses. What's your response today? Are you still a skeptic? It's okay, just don't stay there. Move from your skepticism to understand the reality of this God in Jesus Christ, a historical person that was here for a period of time. The church has existed for over 2,000 years, retelling stories of faith and life. Stories of real people like a centurion, a mother who has lost a son and a husband, and a sinful woman who came to experience wholeness and forgiveness. God has visited his people. Receive his compassion, his love, his forgiveness. Respond to his authority. He wants to be Lord of your life. And when he is, you're demonstrating the faith of the centurion. That's an amazing faith. Jesus closed out this section with a parable. Let me read it. Then he turned to the woman and said to Simon, look at this woman kneeling here. When I entered your home, you didn't offer me water to wash the dust off my feet, but she has washed them with her tears and wiped them with her hair. You didn't greet me with a kiss, it was the custom of the day, but from the time I first came in, she has not stopped kissing my feet. You neglected the courtesy of olive oil to anoint my head, another custom, but she has anointed my feet with rare perfume. I tell you, her sins, they are many, have been forgiven. And she has shown me much love. But a person who is forgiven little shows only little love. Then Jesus said to the woman, can you imagine the eye contact? Looking into the eyes of Jesus, if you're that woman, your sins are forgiven. And the men at the table, typical, said among themselves, who is this man that he goes around forgiving sins? And Jesus said to the woman, your faith has saved you. Go in peace. That's my prayer for each of us today. Is that we might know the love and forgiveness of Jesus and express that in lives of faith filled with love, going from this place knowing his peace. Amen.